Was the Copenhagen Summit on Climate Change a lost opportunity, or did it open the way for a future action? And which were the national responses to the outcomes of the summit? On January 7, 2010, the Department of International Relations and the Faculty of Arts of the University of Malta organized a symposium entitled National Responses to Global Action. The symposium was open to all stakeholders and to the student community. Campus FM is broadcasting the proceedings in three parts. This is the second part, where Carmen Sammut, a lecturer in Environment and International Relations, will first introduce the subject and the speakers. Good morning. I welcome you to this panel discussion that will also include comments and questions from participants. In the first part of the symposium, we have listened to a political scientist, an economist and expert on small islands, a scientist, a legal expert, and the insights of a representative of civil society. They have provided us with ample food for thought for our discussion, and I would like to thank them for their input. On December the 18th, the day in which the summit was supposed to end, an old colleague, who is also a passionate environmentalist, wrote to me saying, "Things are not looking too good for the planet. Do you still have plans for a post-Copenhagen seminar?" And my answer was yes. Global action, and or global inaction for that matter, have implications for each nation and for each individual. And it needs to be discussed in an interdisciplinary way, as we have done this morning. Moreover, it is one of the roles and obligations of our university to provide a platform for a public sphere debate on the ongoing developments regarding this vital matter. Climate change action is indeed about political and economic decisions, but it is also about a change of behavior at a micro level. It therefore entails cultural changes, and a rational and open debate is a means to both these ends. I feel honored and humbled that so many stakeholders have shown keen interest to participate this morning. So let me introduce the panel members. I have on my right the Honorable Minister for Resources, Andrew Rilla Furs, George Policino, who is responsible for climate change and energy, and I'm saying this because there are some very familiar faces around this table, but we also have international students in this symposium. The Honorable Mr. Leo Brincat, Labour Party Shadow Minister, responsible for climate change issues. We have Carmel Cacopardo, spokesperson on sustainable development for the Green Party, known as Alternativa Democratica. Dr. Chris Chantar, the Permanent Secretary in the Ministry for Resources and Rural Affairs. There's engineer Marco Cremona, hydrologist and environmental consultant, member of the committee entrusted with the formulation of a national strategy for the adaptation to climate change. We have engineer Peter Grima, the technical officer, chief technical officer at Enel Malta. His portfolio includes electricity generation and distribution operations, so he is the guy to call when you have a blackout, and major projects and development of the generation of distribution systems also on EU affairs. Then there is Miss Caroline Muscat, the assistant editor of the Sunday Times, who specializes in environmental issues. David Spiteri Gingell, who drafted the proposed national strategy for policy and abatement measures relating to the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. Dr. Harry Vassallo, the editor of the Sunday paper Illum, who has a strong background in environmental activism, also known as the former chairperson of Alternativa. Dr. Carl Vella, lawyer in the office of the Permanent Secretary in the Ministry of Resources and Rural Affairs, who was very much involved in the Copenhagen summit on behalf of Malta. So as you can see, it is indeed a wonderfully big panel. I'm sure they have a lot to say, but I have to appeal to the members to give us brief and pointed answers so that we will have time for the participation of our audience. Minister Policino, four days before Christmas, you wrote an article in the Times entitled Frozen Climate Process, where you wrote, where you said, the climate change conference in Copenhagen was almost a total disaster, a total failure. The so-called accord falls considerably short of the EU expectations, and you gave the reasons why. And you said that the only two meaningful results were the commitment to limit the rise in the Earth's temperature to no more than 2 degrees and a limited package of financial aid. So let me ask a two-pronged question. What was Malta's position in the EU summit in Brussels and later its role in Copenhagen? And is Malta well geared to reach the ambitious EU promises?
Thank you, first of all, for inviting me over for this symposium. So what was our role, both in the meetings prior to Copenhagen as well as in Copenhagen? Basically, the discussions in Brussels, at least the last two discussions prior to Copenhagen, concentrated mostly on the strategic side of how the negotiations should be tackled. Because the position of the European Union was very well formulated much before that those last two meetings. I have to say, basically, the European Union's position was concentrating on 3 points. One is that there have to be comparable emission reduction by not just those which have already put in their contribution until 2012 for the Kyoto, but the emission reduction has to be shouldered by others. One has to understand that until today, only 30% of the world's emissions are being tackled through the Kyoto Protocol. The rest is simply not being addressed. So the European Union made it very clear, even much before Copenhagen, that it will be ready to move from a 20% reduction, when we say 20% as compared to the 1990 levels of emission, to move towards a 30% reduction on two conditions. One is that other countries have to shoulder a comparable effort, namely those countries which are either developed or those countries which are developing countries who have very active economies, such as, for instance, China, Brazil, South Africa, India, in order to come on board and define also a specific target in their emissions. So that's one condition. The second condition being, second out of three conditions, is there has to be a loading, as much as possible, equitable loading, towards financing for adaptation measures. Not just by the developing countries, but also by the developed countries, but also by some of the developing countries, as well as loading as to targets with regards to mitigation by also developing countries. The third point on which the European Union was very much insisting is there has to be a measure of great transparency, both with regards to the overseeing and monitoring of what is being done or what will be done by each nation with regards to CO2 reduction, as well as transparency with regards to how the finances will be utilized mostly for adaptation measures. Malta's position was very much similar to this. In my interventions, I always made the point that we are for the European Union to shoulder the 30% reduction, but we have to stick to these conditions. Mostly the condition that other countries come on board. Otherwise, if we keep on simply addressing 30% of the emissions, even if the European Union goes to 40 or even 50%, it will get us simply nowhere. Because we all have to understand that the real target that we have to reach globally is in order to have a temperature increase of not more than 2%, sorry, 2 degrees centigrade as an average.
Are we well geared to reach the EU targets?
So we have basically, I will not go into much detail, but we have basically two main targets. One is to reduce our emissions by circa 20% by 2020. As the report of the committee has indicated, yes, on that count, I think we can manage to reach that target by 2020. With regards to the other target, to reach the 10% renewable energy from all our energy consumption, I have to underline this issue, because when we say 10% of our energy, it's not 10% of the energy generated, but it's 10% of the total energy consumed by us. So that basically implies not just the electricity we generate in our power stations, but also the energy we consume with regards to transportation as well as aviation.
Thank you very much. I'd like now to ask the Labour spokesperson, Leo Brinkat, what is the opposition's view of Malta's international role during the Copenhagen summit, and whether you feel that Malta can reach the EU targets?
Yes, first of all, I thank the organisers for this kind invitation. Obviously, as the Minister quite rightly pointed out, Malta's role was guided and pushed along by the EU criteria themselves. So in my brief intervention, I will limit myself to what I personally consider to be the country's sort of specific angle to whether we are geared or not to meet the challenges ahead. My personal opinion is that on paper, and I emphasize the word on paper, we seem to be better geared to meet our climate goals and targets than we are to meet our renewable energy targets. But it is a matter of concern that although Parliament unanimously approved our climate strategy way back in September, if I'm not mistaken, 4 months have elapsed, and as far as I know, very little progress has been made on the mitigation aspect, while on the other hand, the adaptation measures still need to be formulated, agreed upon, discussed, before we can even start thinking seriously of actually implementing them. If my memory serves me well, Ambassador Michael Zamit-Kotayer once had said that it is better to put adaptation first, and having absorbed the message, we can then understand mitigation better and move on to these measures. My biggest preoccupation isn't a question of lack of political will or whether the politicians are up to it or not, but a general feeling of complacency, which can prove to be our undoing as a country, rather than just as politicians, regarding the national response to the global action on climate change, which is the main theme of the seminar which we are discussing here today. Apart from the government's plans to reach the targets, which I feel are mainly focused on the supply end of the equation, I still need to be convinced that there is a deep commitment as a country and a strong political will to actually reduce our dependence on fossil fuels. This still has to be seen to be believed. As for the climate strategy, although we have approved it unanimously in Parliament, our biggest concern is that the final strategy, as approved by Parliament, still contains a number of wish lists which still need further studies. So this can delay the actual implementation process even further. I think that to be positive, in order to succeed, we need a new type of synergy, where environmentalists should work with politicians, government, scientists, business leaders, and the media to demonstrate through effective measures the way forward. People have often mentioned the fact that Malta has been amongst the first to put climate on the national agenda of the UN, actually, not the national, the agenda of the UN. It is a pity, but that we seem to be falling among the last when it comes to doing anything tangible about it. I'll give you an example. The pre-budget document issued in 2008 had stated that according to the latest figures, energy efficiency in the manufacturing sector had worsened. But let me come to a more important point, the aspect which Professor Lino Bregurio mentioned, sustainable development. We all know we have a National Commission for Sustainable Development. When I asked about this progress, I was told by the Prime Minister that it last met in 2006. And I still have to find out whether this commission had its findings taken on board by government or by the commission appointed by the minister, sort of factored in when the strategy was being formulated for climate change in Malta. I might touch upon other points at a later stage, although I have a prepared speech here. I'll just touch upon tourism in my concluding remarks. We all know about the Deutsche Bank research report of April 2008, which had claimed that Malta was the European destination with the most to lose if current global warming trends continue. My concern is not what Deutsche Bank said, but that although it should have set alarm bells ringing, in my opinion, it did not. And going through past cuttings and statements by MTA spokespersons, I found that in spite of the fact that Malta is being specifically singled out, rightly or wrongly, as potentially the biggest loser, it had been dismissed at that time as a hypothetical scenario which an MTA spokesman did not feel could have been realistically addressed then. This concerns me because we depend on tourism more than other Mediterranean destinations. So, in my opinion, the extent of the problem for us can be further aggravated than it can be for other Mediterranean countries. Perhaps in the second round of our discussions, we can touch upon two important aspects, the issue of health. I was very concerned when an Malta spokesman once said that health considerations do not come into CO2. They are only linked to environmental pollution. The issue of climate refugees, which I think concerns us very much, and also the aspect of the carbon market itself, which I think needs to be addressed very seriously and proactively in the coming months and weeks. Thank you.
So let me ask the same question to Carmel Cacopardo, the Green Party spokesperson, whether he feels that Malta is geared to meet the EU targets.
I doubt whether the targets will be achieved for a multitude of reasons. We have been late in starting, we are slow, and there is a lack of coordination. There is no integrated approach to action on climate change. Each and every sector is practically acting on its own. Controversy is generally not about the proposed measures, but rather on their siting, where they are placed. And the search for adequate solutions has not been eased by the high-handedness of the authorities. This has not contributed to the creation of a climate of trust between the authorities and the public. And this is so evident in the Delimara Power Station case, the Santantnane waste treatment plant, and in the former case, the decision as to the technology to be used was taken conclusively prior to the conclusion of the EIA. So what is the purpose of the EIA? What trust will the public have in the EIA, which is assessing whether a technology proposed is suitable and will achieve the aims indicated? In the latter case, in the Santantnane case, an incomplete EIA did nothing to convince residents that their interests were being taken care of. We speak about the contribution of energy to climate change and emphasize the linkage with Sicily, the submarine connector with Sicily, but ignore another possibility, which is the Desert Tech project, which, although it is slightly of a longer duration in its actuation, could solve much more of our problems. We also, within this context, one could also point to a failure of environmental diplomacy on the part of Malta's foreign ministry to make use of its contacts with North African countries, those contacts which we always claim are very good, to make use of such initiatives. We concentrate on mega projects, but ignore small measures which, if applied, can accumulate to large impacts. I am referring to measures related to use of solar energy in buildings. MEPA has not, to date, issued compulsory directives for new buildings to have solar water heaters. This has been in the grapevine for years and has not been implemented. This could also lead eventually to the removal of the possibility to develop penthouses, because roofs have to be accessible in order to place solar water heaters, and most of our roofs are taken up by penthouses. And obviously this generates a lot of income to developers which finance the major political parties. And this is the reason for non-action. Thank you.
Thank you. It was not meant to be like this. I prepared my questions and all the people. Now I'm going to address the left-hand side of the table for quite a while. I want to turn to the journalist, to Dr. Harry Vassallo. And my question is, in Western democracies, long-term climate change policies are sometimes stalled by partisanship and short-termism. Parties need to get elected. We know that the public can be rather ambivalent on the merits of any long-term action, especially in times of economic uncertainty. Do you see the possibility of a consensus-based agenda?
It's in our business interest always to be optimistic. We all hate to be the Cassandra announcing doom. It's not good for business. People don't want to listen. They won't listen to you. And nobody has the authority to announce the end of the earth. But we are all pussyfooting about all this. I think it's not only politics. Politicians are the weakest in this situation. They have to say things that people want to hear, mostly in a democracy. There are very few politicians who are in this state of grace where they can afford to speak their mind when it is going to be an electoral cost. Politicians normally are answerable first to their party structure, next to the wave of keen partisan activists, and finally to the voters. They are also answerable to the party financiers. Even if they do think that things are pretty grim, they will avoid saying it, because none of all these people want to have the bad news uttered by their side. Seeing that so much of the world's power is in the hands of democracies, the major economies of the world are democracies, other than places like China. It is a structural weakness. Another structural weakness is the media. Some of us think that the media exists to inform the public. The media generally exists to make money, and they will only inform the public because it is their way of making money, and they will inform the public in a parallel way that politicians act. They chase the story, the ones which people will want to listen to, in a way which people they think will understand. The fact is that when you listen to technical people who are serious, the scenario before us is truly grim. Now, if you look at not Maltese newspapers or Maltese media, but the world media in general, the mainstream media, has dealt with the Copenhagen conference or the whole issue of climate change as another issue. I don't think that it even competes with something like the World Cup. I think if we had the World Cup on, we will have an occasion soon to compare it, no? It's in South Africa. We should measure up the attention given to climate change, this cataclysm before us, to the attention that will be given to the World Cup. This is not just another issue. We are looking at something that hasn't happened in human history. In fact, it goes. The last time we had anything close to it was far into prehistory. For us to deal with this like another issue, oh yes, we will sort it out somehow, is very seriously a threat in itself. I think our structures, democracy, the media, capitalism, I mean the famous case of Exxon spending $22 million to finance the deniers from 98 till they were caught out by the Royal Society, not publicly rebuked by the Royal Society of Great Britain for financing all the deniers on climate change. It's quite amazing. But there was profit to be made from selling oil. So that is an interest. A legitimate interest.
Now, Harry, the media have exposed some of these stories. They do act as watchdogs, but they also have a role to influence public opinion, global public opinion. And I'd like to turn to Caroline Muscat. My question is, do you think that during the Copenhagen summit and afterwards, the media did have a role to create more awareness about the issues at stake, and whether the media should have a role to induce sustained support for combating climate change?
Well, if we consider the threat in front of us, then definitely the media has a very significant role to play. The Copenhagen summit did get the attention of the world's media. It was not the media that failed, it was the politics that failed. So while the media has a certain obligation in this matter, it depends on the context. It has to report the context. Now, climate change presents a particular problem in terms of communication because it's a very, very complex issue. It's being described as a kind of slow developing catastrophe. So it's very difficult to communicate a crisis that is not affecting people directly. There's a lot of science involved, there's a lot of policies involved, there's a lot of treaties involved. It's extremely complex. So we have the challenge of having to bring this down to a very simple level that is, you know, communicated easily to the public. The nature of the problem has presents its own challenges. The nature of politics continues to add to the problems because, first of all, the political system took a very long time to acknowledge the science. I was working for Greenpeace International in the 1980s, 1990s, when we were talking about climate change, when we were being shunned. When the politicians finally accepted the science of climate change, then the media interest on the issue automatically increased. So it's a role that has to be played. There's a role to be played by scientists as well. Scientists have a habit of, you know, sitting down doing their studies, but not actually coming forward and talking about economic policy, talking about public activism and all of these things. We cannot underestimate the role of the media in climate change because of the problem itself. It is a problem that is going to influence our futures directly. And I have to say this, it is too big a problem to leave to elected officials. Because they are guided by a span of time in which they are there and they have to appease their constituents, as Dr. Vassallo was saying. So the political system is not exactly geared up to handle such a problem. I think we need more effort from the political side to look at this more as a long-term issue and create long-term initiatives in this regard. But I think one to mention an opportunity and a development that the media, because the traditional media is quite limited, it's national in focus and it's quite limited in dealing with this kind of problem that actually defies national boundaries, and that is the internet. I think this time at the Copenhagen summit, the internet has really shown its potential. People did not need to go to Copenhagen. Copenhagen came to their living room. There were live updates, videos, so they could really participate in the process if they chose to. Tick, Tick, Tick set a perfect example. It was a coalition of organizations around the world that mobilized 50 million people to make their demands for a fair and ambitious deal. So I think when it comes to climate change, because of the nature of the problem and its political, its international sphere, I think the history of climate change will be written through the internet medium. In that sense.
Thank you very much, Caroline. Now, water and energy are concern for the Maltese. Tariffi ta' dawlu l-ilma, utility tariffs are on the top of the national agenda. They've been for quite a while. But water and energy are also long-term concerns for climate change politics. And Engineer Mario Cremona has been actively Marco Cremona has been actively advocating that the most imminent problem that will be faced by Malta is the lack of water. And I'd like to ask him whether we can do to mitigate and to adapt to this, and whether the water issue was something that was discussed during the Copenhagen summit.
First of all, I'm not a politician, so I am allowed to bring bad news. First of all, when I look at Copenhagen, I think it's embarrassing that we go to Copenhagen and we rest on our laurels when we say that we were the initiator of discussion of climate change in way back in 1989. But since then, unfortunately, we've got one of the worst track records in the EU when it comes to controlling emissions and sustainability issues. Water. It's a fact that the biggest impact on Malta when it comes to climate change will be on water. And this will come about not because of a slight increase in sea levels, which will affect our aquifers, as reported by the Prime Minister in Copenhagen, but through reduced rainfall, annual rainfall, and the little we have will come in storms, which is difficult to collect and reuse. Yes, this is a fact, but the issue is that in all probability, with the current rates of extraction of our groundwater, our aquifers will be long gone before climate change actually happens. Two-thirds of our water comes from groundwater. It might come as a surprise to most people, because most people actually think that most of our water comes from reverse osmosis. It does not. Two-thirds of our water still comes from our groundwater, and our survivability, irrespective of climate change, actually depends on us having a strategic, sustainable source of water, which is free water, from underground. Indeed, there are studies from water quality data that our aquifers will be gone, or rather rendered useless, within 15 years' time. So if any people were concerned that there was a recent increase of 20% in water tariffs last week, this will unfortunately be an annual event. We must get prepared for water tariffs to be increasing steadily year after year because of the deterioration of our water sources. Professor Biguglio said that even if there is a small risk in a life and death situation, and even if the level of uncertainty is high, you take action and you get out of the house. Well, there is no uncertainty on the rate of deterioration of our aquifers. And it is a life and death situation, but unfortunately, in this country, there is no sense of urgency about the matter. Indeed, in my opinion, I think we should actually today, rather than be discussing climate change, we should have a national fora for discussion on water. What are the impacts of climate change? There are direct and indirect. I've mentioned direct impacts like reduction in rainfall, but I even believe that the indirect impacts of climate change on Malta are even more immediate and even more urgent. These indirect impacts come from the various directives which we, as an EU member state, have to abide to, and we will be fined for not doing this, and also because the increase in the price of fossil fuels. And Malta is vulnerable in both cases. How do you combat the impacts of climate, the indirect impacts of climate change? Well, it's very simple, really, by being more efficient, by not wasting resources like energy and water, by doing things which we should be doing anyway, irrespective of climate change. 10 years ago, the buzzword was sustainability. Today it's climate change, but essentially they're really one and the same thing. Have we achieved some form of sustainability in this country in the last 10 years? I don't think so. Our power stations are 20% efficient, which means 72% of the oil and the money we are paying is actually going to heating the sea. We are still building houses which are very energy inefficient. And in my view, it is impossible for us to reach the targets given the inefficiency of the buildings we are building today and which hopefully will last, 40, 50 years. In conclusion, we will not meet our targets unless we move from words into action. We must move away from end-of-pipe solutions. And we must engage solutions which really engage the public. It is useless putting infrastructure at the end of the pipe when the people are not informed on what they have to do in reducing waste. This is like having a pipe with lots of leaks. It is better to fill up the leaks rather than pump more water into the pipe.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you, Mario. I now want to turn to the right-hand side of the table. Engineer Peter Grima is from Enel Malta, and we know that energy demand in Malta is on the increase. What is Enel Malta doing to generate more energy while it reduces emissions and other hazardous toxic wastes, especially in view of the targets which we have to meet?
What is Enel Malta doing to meet the energy demand, and how are we going to meet that energy demand and at the same time respect the EU emissions targets? Well, basically, the emissions targets in respect of climate change are directly related to energy consumption. The more energy that is consumed, the more CO2 that is generated. In order to reduce CO2 emissions, we have to either reduce energy consumption or we have to substitute energy production from CO2 emitting sources with energy from non-CO2 emitting sources. So basically, one of the main pillars of the strategy to meet the targets is to either increase the penetration of renewable sources in Malta and at the same time to control energy demand increase. We plan, as Enel Malta, to control the demand increase. We intend to meet the demand increase, definitely, but we intend to take measures to control the energy demand mainly by means of our smart meter project. With our smart meters, we will have a greater control on the electricity distribution network. We will be able to identify where we have losses, pinpoint losses, and take corrective action. Our consumers will be able to get direct feedback from the meters as to what their consumption is, what the effect of that consumption is on CO2 emissions, and they'll be able to take corrective action. In fact, this is not something unique to Enemalta. It's a strategy which will be and is being implemented by all the major European utilities. In order to meet the demand, however, we have two major projects in mind. Our first project is the new generating plant which we're installing at Delamara. This plant will be operating at approximately 46% efficiency. Once this plant comes into operation, we will save, mainly through substituting production at Marsa, approximately 400,000 to 450,000 tons of CO2 annually. This is over 20% of the current CO2 emissions by Enemalta. The new plant is also very flexible. Because of that flexibility, we will be able to improve our operating efficiency on the existing plant, which will also have an effect on reducing CO2 emissions. We also intend, and we're working in parallel, to install an interconnector to Sicily. This interconnector will allow us to purchase electricity from generating plants which have larger economies of scale. They're able to generate at higher efficiencies than we're able to generate. A typical modern large generating plant will generate electricity at 50, 55, in some cases even 60% efficiency. We'll be able to tap into electricity produced from that type of plant. We'll also be able to tap into the major European electricity markets, where there are a number of diverse production sources. This will have two effects. One effect will be that it will reduce price volatility, since the production sources are different and have different price drivers. And the other will be that the overall average emissions of CO2 are lower. It's been said that we haven't done anything in the past to reduce, or we've done very little in the past to reduce emissions. I'd just like to end by pointing out that from 1990 to 2007, 2008, electricity demand more than doubled. CO2 emissions increased by about 47%. If we had done nothing, if we had a business-as-usual situation, CO2 emissions would have doubled as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I want to move on to Dr. Carl Vella, who has been at the Copenhagen Summit. And my question is, by 2013... all EU states, including Malta, have to abide to a common European emissions trading scheme. How are we preparing for this?
Yes, so the emissions trading scheme, which you mentioned, arises from the EU climate change and energy package, which was negotiated in the past years and decided in December 2008. Malta's role in these negotiations was, as a small island state, but also a member of the European Union, in promoting the needs and the requirements of such a vulnerable state, including not only the possibility for mitigation efforts, but also the needs of Malta as a vulnerable state with regards to its adaptation needs and the costs. Yes, so within the Copenhagen discussions, Malta played quite an active role in the discussions, not only in the formulation of the EU position, but also, as many of you know, Malta had One of the most important things which arose from the conference with respect to Malta nationally is the fact that Malta had an application for it, Annex 1, to join Annex 1, which was discussed throughout the conference. There were bilaterals held throughout the conference, and in fact this was one of the positive aspects of the Copenhagen conference, where actually the COP decided to adopt Malta's proposal and accepted that Malta would join Annex 1. Even though the EU went to Copenhagen with a common position on I would say most of the issues on the table, throughout the 2 weeks, since obviously they were negotiations, there had to be compromises on the positions in the EU, and Malta played an active role in many of the discussions where these compromises were discussed, in particular, for example, aspects which affected Malta directly, for example, the adaptation discussions, discussions on the bunker fuels mitigation aspects, where Malta ensured that the interests not only of the EU but also of similar states in the position, developed country states which have a particular interest in these issues, are safeguarded.
Okay.
There are two more particular specific roles which Malta played. You could say very important roles. One was the fact that Ambassador Michael Zamikutayer, who was chairing one of the ad hoc working groups on long-term cooperative action, had a key role in managing and moving the negotiations forward on many of the specific issues within the Copenhagen Agreement, and also, I must say, and also many of the months leading up to the conference.
My next question is to Dr. Chris Chanter. And we know that EU targets, like the emissions trading scheme, have an economic cost for member states, but they may also have social costs. Which are the main challenges, and can we ensure that the less fortunate members of society are not penalized?
Yes, thank you very much. Good morning to everyone. I will not sit here to say how other people have failed. I will say how I myself have failed in addressing climate change. Climate change is not about Copenhagen. Climate change is about us. Are we ready to do things? We have to change. We have to change mentalities. I tried hard to have a waste treatment facility to recover energy from waste for all the tonnages of waste generated in Malta, but I failed. And we have a facility that will treat one-third of this waste to recover energy, clean, pure energy from our waste. But I have failed. I have failed to ascertain, okay, that when our officers issue tenders for example, the distribution of light bulbs, they will not be criticized. But they have been criticized, and I have failed. And I have failed in issuing calls for application to get people working in the subject of climate change, and no one applies. I have failed. So it is time for us to see how each and every one of us is failing. People like Carl, who spent 2 weeks in Copenhagen sleeping in suits on the floor and eating cold sandwiches and very bad coffee, okay, do not come freely in life. Okay? And it was not just 2 weeks. It was 3 months, 4 months, and more trying to come to a conclusion, trying to come to some concerted decision where they can communicate things. Yeah, I have failed in getting the architect profession in designing energy-efficient buildings. And I have failed in making people understand how breaking away from subsidies will help them reduce energy consumption. And this is climate change. This is purely climate change. Whether it's an NGO, whether it's the media, whether it's the politician, whether it's me as a civil servant, we do not get any brownie points. We do not get paid extra money for doing this, but we have failed. And obviously, I represent a workforce of 3,500 people, but none of them are to blame. They work hard. They do their best. Rest assured. But breaking away from a mentality is not easy. It is not easy. And climate change and Copenhagen and all the talk about all that is about changing mentalities. I read with interest how Germany has managed to embark, okay, and we have a learned representative from Germany here. In 2006, Germany's renewable industry is responsible for a turnover of 11.5 billion euros. And we have failed to get people interested in buying a solar water heater, which is half the price. 50% of the investment cost, government will pay for it. Out of 4,000 projected installations, we have managed to get 2,200 installations. Okay. Maybe electricity prices are still very cheap. Perhaps, I don't know. In 2005, Britain, the environmental industries, had a turnover of 25 billion. So there are opportunities here. Whether you're a technician, as my person on the right, whether you're a politician, as my person on the left, there are opportunities for us. So why do we sit here and say, but we have failed, we have failed, we have failed? No, there are opportunities ahead, let's grab them. And we have our climate change strategy, thanks for the people who have formulated it. It has been communicated widely to scientists, to architects, to engineers, to NGOs, to media. And we have agreed upon it. Let us rope in support and deliver it to fruition. And then I also read in a recent presentation done in December 2009, in 2006, the waste-to-energy sector contributed approximately 2.5% of the total renewable energy produced in Europe. Waste-to-energy. By 2012, that will account for 5%. Approximately 58 million tons of waste will generate enough energy for 27 million people. And yet, in Malta, we seem to be this issue of recovery of energy from waste so problematic. So there are opportunities, and I do not want to sound too negative because I have an audience of students in front of me, and I would like to rope your support as well. We as a ministry, as the MRA, we are looking for competent people working in the sector. And without you, with a handful of people, we surely cannot deliver the climate change strategy with all its 80 tasks ahead, okay? We cannot deliver it alone. We need people, whether you're in industry, whether you're in an NGO, whether you're in the media, wherever you are, we need people to help us deliver this strategy. And I am sure that each and every initiative in here will cause controversy. When we, for the first time, we monitored the movement of water for commercial use, 16 hawkers, they were furious at us. And there was just one person sitting in an office trying to handle the wrath. There was no glory, no praise for this person. No praise. But these people exist, and they work silently to try to deliver a solution. And we should be appreciative of this. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You confirmed something which feminist authors in international relations say, that the personal is international. That means that personal action can have international implications. And I liked two statements which you have made, that there is this struggle to break away from the current culture that somehow, and that we cannot deliver climate change policy without people's support. Now, David Spiteri-Gingell drafted the proposed national strategy for policy and abatement measures. How do we engage the public? Are there any solutions are there any proposals for a solution in the strategy?
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation. Just, I would like to make a slight correction. I did not draft the strategy on my own. I was the chairman of a committee, which I had the pleasure to work with, and the product of the work that we delivered was a collective one. Earlier this decade, I was responsible for pensions reform. And one of the things that we did to try to design a strategy was that we carried out focus groups and held surveys to try to understand the behavioral perception of people from different walks of life, different ages, different social cohorts. How do they think about their pension? You may be surprised to learn that very few people think about their pension. You may be also very surprised to learn that very little people actually save for their retirement. And, you know, when you ask the people about why, oh, gosh, 40 years' time, God knows where I'd be. Tomorrow I may walk and, you know, God knows where I'll be. Why should I think 40 years down the road? A lot of people realize what their pension means when they actually retire.
and all of a sudden discover that they cannot face the fall from the standard of living they were accustomed to. There are countries that know that their pension systems are not sustainable. France, Greece, to mention two that are close to us. And yet they will not make the changes because they back down in face of the unions. So why do I mention pensions? Because this is something we know, something we live, and something we see and touch. Climate change is so much more nebulous. How much more difficult it is. If we can't communicate to get ourselves, to prepare ourselves better for our retirement, how far more complex it will be to design the instruments to get the communities, the political classes, the unions, to think and prepare for climate change. You know, I've become slightly more cynical as I get older. It's quite sad, actually, because I was quite a person who believed in the better things in life. But, you know, when I hear politicians talking about we need to do this and we need to more and we need to do that, when we come to do the tough actions, you don't find them there. Let me mention one particular action. It was stated here that the climate change strategy had no demand mechanisms. I will not enter into that. I will just mention one demand recommendation that we made. Increase the price of energy. It is the only elasticity that works. It's the only sanction that gets people to change their behavior. Before the tariffs were changed, the price of electricity in Malta, you may wish to know, was still based on $25 a barrel when we were buying that particular oil at $80 a barrel, let alone the inefficiency of Malta. Yet you mention price, you mention instruments for change. Wow, the furies are let loose. We will not handle climate change unless we are sincere in what we say, and we leave the hypocrisy of whatever what that is in our closets. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm sure that we have stirred a number of points which will, you know, you want to comment about, and I've already noted a few people who are raising their hands. The first one was Arnold Cassola. So, please, we're recording this session, which will be broadcast on Campus FM at some point. So wait for the microphone and speak into the microphone.
Thank you. Thank you. I agree with David that you need increases to change mentalities, but you also need the alternatives so that people can revert to. If you don't have them, then it becomes a problem. I'm also impressed at the frankness of Engineer Chantar, who, not being a politician, was very frank in listing a whole list of millions of failures. But in democracies, then somebody has to shoulder the responsibility of the failures. I wanted to ask the minister. The minister said that we will be able to tackle our target of 10% renewable energy by 2010, but never said how. And I ask this question because it seems, from what we've seen in the past, the only project is this famous Sical Baida, which was announced over a year and a half ago before any proper studies were done. Then the day after the European elections, we finally realized that we had to measure the wind to see if it's feasible. And now we have to wait for a year and a half. This is supposed to produce nearly 5% of the target, right? Half our target. But the minister says, let's hope it works, because if it doesn't work, nitol bulalla, no? So if let's hope it works. Let's hope that we don't have to nitol bulalla, because then I think we have some problems on how to get to this. So what are the other, first of all, 5%? And if it doesn't work, if the wind doesn't work, how do we get to it? And the second thing is most countries prepare the plans for the future based on studies, scientific studies. Now, we've just seen Mr. Peter Gatt telling us before that we are the only country in the EU not to have a geological survey, possibly the only country in the world not to have a geological survey of our country. On what are we basing our projects and proposals for the future if we have not even got the basic thing on our geological survey, on our water resources, etc.? Thank you.
We have Alan Daydoun over there.
thank you. In its criticism of the Copenhagen process, IUCN Mediterranean basically said that there was a major absentee from Copenhagen, which was the sea. So this criticism, I think, is very valid for Malta, being an island state with a marine area which is 20 times the size of our terrestrial area, not accounting for the search and rescue area, which is almost the size of the UK. I think this is a very valid criticism for Malta. And in fact, the geologist rightly said that we need people from the earth sciences and so on. But we also need people to actually monitor what is happening to our seas. Malta might not have a geology service, somebody rightly said, but Malta is also one of the few countries not to have a marine research station and a marine research vessel. Okay, some landlocked countries even have such a vessel, but Malta, having such a large marine area, we are not basically monitoring what is happening to our seas, what is happening to our fish stocks as a result of climate change. We think that the impact on our seas is limited to sea level changes, which is a great misconception. The sea level around the Maltese islands is actually decreasing, not rising, and this is a big misconception. So I suggest that there should be a bigger involvement of scientists, because there are institutes at university which have actually been monitoring sea level for the past years. 10 years at least, there is a sea level monitoring station at Port Thomas, for example, and the data showing that the sea level is actually going down. There is a big misconception out there that Malta is threatened by a rising sea level. In my opinion, there are much larger impacts on our seas. For example, the acidification of the oceans, of the sea. The seas are basically becoming more and more acidic. Our fish stocks are changing, and fish are migrating to other areas. You have these alien species coming in from the Suez Canal. So, and the man in the street actually does not know anything about these things. If you tell him, what's the impact, what is, in your opinion, the impact on the sea? He might tell you an increase in sea level, which is wrong. Okay. So I think, being a maritime maritime country, and I liked a lot the suggestion given by Dr. Simon Borch on the high seas. Basically, the Mediterranean is an excellent case study for the high seas, because very few countries in the Mediterranean have actually declared their exclusive economic zone. Most of the Mediterranean is high seas. So actually, we need people, even people from the law section, from the environmental law section, to actually study the potential of the high seas in the Mediterranean. Thank you.
Very interesting points. If there are students listening, though, a number of gaps have been identified, and I'm sure that most of us would be, you know, very interested in knowing the answers when some of this research actually takes place. And also it shows that politics and economics needs to go back to science and to base its decisions on what scientists are telling us. Now, Petra Lamone.
I am going to mention a very basic matter, and that is, Dr. Cremona, speak to the children and to the mothers. The mothers sit at home and do their homework with the kids. Teach the kids what is happening. Write simple stories that they can understand and read in Maltese and in English, for the mothers to know what is happening. Perhaps the future, certainly the future, is in their hands, not in ours.
Alfred Baldacchino.
From what I've heard this morning, at least up to this very minute, and from what I read on the internet on what happened in Copenhagen, it seems that this is a mirror image of the discussions there and there, lamenting and a self-defeatist, even this morning, you've had self-defeatist admittance of failure on taking action on the subject. And besides, the main points on which such reasoning have been built are economic, seemingly that one needs and one wants to keep the status quo, energy and all the physical aspects of this planet, and bypassing completely the biodiversity aspect, as if this is of no importance, or as if the most important living species on this planet is Homo sapiens. From scientific papers that I read, it is very worrying that the displacement of species and the change in the ecosystems is a problem which is far greater than climate change. For example, a point which is very important is the disappearance of pollinators. Pollinators are those species which pollinate flowers, through which they are the basic source of food supply to the species on the planet. Nothing has been mentioned of that. The changes in climate will obviously change migratory species. It will also change the climates where species will invade other countries, either naturally or also accidentally, and where they will create havoc to the ecosystems of the regions. For example, this morning it was mentioned that the Arctic ice is melting, with the result that the salinity of the region will have an impact on plankton and other microorganisms, which are the food supply, the lowest food supply, which will change the whole system of the larger species, contributing to a decrease in population, to disappearance of population, to changes in migratory routes, and obviously the end result of this change of or displacement of species, whether they are terrestrial or aquatic, both fresh water or marine, will have an impact on the scarcity of food supply on the world population. And this has been completely, completely ignored, as far as I'm aware, at
Thank
least
you.
in this conference today,
yes.
Completely ignored.
We cannot be totally exhaustive in the conference, but it's a point. It's a good point.
You cannot miss such an important point, which is quite a basic point for the existence of men on this blessed rock in the middle of the Mediterranean. Thank you.
Rudolf Ragonesi.
I'd like to take a quick spunto from the reference to Cassandra, which reminds me many years back. A meeting like this, the Minister of Environment at the time walked in, and a fellow environmentalist was there, and he said, Cassandra is here. Of course, Cassandra predicted the fall of Troy, yeah, those who might not know. And I raised a point and said, well, Minister, Cassandra was right. 20 years ago, we were talking about prevention, and as was widely pointed out, and also Mrs. Amit Kutai, I'm glad to know, you stated, has put it on the list of priorities, is to work also towards mitigation rather than adaptation. So we're no longer talking about prevention, but now also about how we have to cope, because really, we have already wasted 20 years of very valuable time. I would like, if I were to mention one or two sentences to the world at large, to the politicians, to the leaders at large, I would say, well, what leaders, with the benefit of hindsight, would have not taken drastically different actions in 1914 and 1939? Today, we have the benefit of hindsight and the benefit of foresight through science. We don't need psychics like Cassandra. We have physics to give us the benefit of foresight and hindsight because things are already happening. Yeah? And this is something that the leaders of the world have to keep in mind, you know, that so many times we regret the actions and the course of action that we have taken. I would think that there are certain points I would like to mention very briefly that really need to be radical in order to affect the changes required. We need to be looking also at regulating certain sectors. Yeah, we saw that the economic situation in the world went through a very difficult time. It's going through a difficult time. We started to try to regulate the banking system, financial system, institutions, etc., yeah, which were collapsing. We need to look at the possibility of also in the future, in the near future, even possibly regulating the insurance sectors, because this is going to be an essential part of the mitigation factor. Yeah, when the major effects start to develop, yeah, the people on the ground are going to be the ones to suffer. To what extent are they going to be able to turn towards the insurance sector? Yeah, I'll try to be as brief as I can. A couple of very other quick points on regulating. We need to regulate the energy sector. Yeah, it's not just about the leaders and the politicians taking specific actions down the line. Someone mentioned earlier on $30 billion being allocated for mitigation and adaptation measures. Yeah, if you look at ExxonMobil in 2007, it had an astronomical profit of $44 billion. Profit, not sales. $44 billion because of the rise in oil prices. Yeah, there was no windfall tax that was declared. A tax is not there simply to raise money. It is a reform. It is tax reform. If there was a windfall tax of two-thirds, 65%, you go to the oil energy sector and you say, you have this windfall tax. Now, you can avail yourself of tax deductions if you reinvest that 65% in clean energy. Okay? And that 65% in that 1 year of ExxonMobil would have raised your $30 billion. Yeah? Two-thirds of $44 billion. So what I'm saying is the politicians, the leaders, the sectors, the economy, the economics of the world, we were hoping to have more effective change in the last few years. Now we realize it's more serious. And yet, the breadbasket of the world has shrunk because there is far less liquidity today than there was 5 years ago. So I would have been the first to say, I don't want to be negative, but I knew that Copenhagen was not going to reach much of a result because it's far less likely now with the economic situation than it was 5 years ago. But in conclusion, I would say, if you cut the Gordian knot, proverbially, with a bit of lateral thinking, rather than try to tackle the issue of unraveling this knot, which you will never unravel, you need to cut the Gordian knot. And you need to affect tax reform in the energy sector, because by doing that, you will call upon the financial resources to affect change for that 20, 30, 40 billion investment in clean energy directly, either directly to the energy sector or indirectly to the government that will take the tax from it. Yeah, and in that way, the individuals will not suffer, the local economies, the international economies will suffer less of the brunt because that specific tax reform would have a very specific clear target that it can work on. Thank you.
And I'll take the last comment for now and from Dr. Paul Patch.
Well, basically, I have to share a concern that I have. I feel that most of the attitude that is being discussed, although there were hints being thrown here and there, is still we're looking at solutions from a top-down approach. I refer back to what Simone said earlier in her intervention on the need to have civil society being involved and the responsabilization of civil society at all its levels, including, but this does not obviously shift responsibility from policymakers. But policymakers alone cannot, in my opinion, reflect the real needs of the bottom layers if we're going to keep the top-down paradigm. Secondly, I feel that as a consequence of this top-down attitude, the discussions and the worries and whatever and concerns are being hijacked by several groups of people like politicians, scientists, economists, academics, whoever, right? Whoever has a stake in it, and we've listened to a lot of interventions to support this, even my. I have my own vested interest and my hidden agendas as well, as you'll notice in a couple of seconds. But basically, we are not reflecting the needs of other people. Like Dr. Vassallo mentioned earlier, people out there are being concerned on other issues. This is something which is happening, but nobody is paying enough attention to take action. And I feel that this is consequently another consequence of the same top-down approach, where we are looking at, unfortunately, it was one of the parting comments of the previous panel, that we are still looking at technological fixes, which are important. I'm not saying that they are not. I'm not saying that we don't need scientific research to inform our decision-making, whatever. But we are not looking for technological fixes. We are looking for changes, radical changes in our lifestyles. And this is where things really are leaving good results in other countries abroad. Like, for example, this would mean, and it was a conference, in fact, being held in this particular room, a change in mentality, thinking outside the box, looking at different ways of dealing with problems that we are facing. If we're quoting Einstein, if we're going to approach solutions using the same mentality which created the problems, we're wasting time. This leads me to very small points. The emphasis on education, not just information provision, because this is not education. We need to target skills and also attitudes and values, as has been highlighted, to really switch on personal responsibility on every level at the diverse levels of society. And particularly, I hate to say this, but things are being done at school level. Definitely, obviously, this is one of my vested interests. Eco schools is one example. But unfortunately, the future is not just in our kids. We might muck up the future for these kids if we still continue with our lifestyles. So everybody has to put an investment in the whole system, and education should target the whole community, the whole population, not just the kids, but also the adults. Thank you.
You have just listened to the panel discussion presented at the symposium entitled Climate Change, National Responses to Global Action, which was organized by the Department of International Relations at the Aula Magna in Valletta on January the 7th. Campus FM will proceed to broadcast the second part of this panel discussion today week.